everybody. I have just one announcement before service starts, and it concerns the Time, Talent, and Treasure silent auction, which ended last week, and the results are in. This year's auction brought in $7,837 to the church. I don't know if that's a record. It's the highest. Okay, yeah. I don't remember ever hearing a number that high for the auction. Thank you to everyone who donated and bid on items. Your generosity is heartwarming and greatly appreciated. To find out what you won, pick up your treasures and or make a payment, see Kevin C. in the social hall after the service today. And where's Kevin? He's in back. Okay. And if anyone feels moved to concentrate our energy a little bit, might just help to make us feel more like a community instead of a bunch of scattered entities in the sanctuary here. So thanks, everyone.
Installation this afternoon. I wanted to make sure everyone knew that they are invited and welcome to come to it. It's 2:00 this afternoon. You can come hang out and help us install our new minister.
And there's food out.
And there's food. Our opening words today. Welcome to this community, which we call into life, and which in turn calls us to life. Welcome to the joy of being a verb, of acting in the world. Even on your day off, when you don't have to work. Let's take a moment to pause, to rest and relax in the circle of this community, where it is safe for us to ask, what do we want to be when we grow up? What do we want to do when we don't have to work? What calls to us?
Blessed is the fire that burns deep in the soul. It is the flame of the human spirit. It is the fire of reason, the fire of compassion, the fire of community, the fire of justice. It is the fire of love burning deep in the human heart. Please stand in body and spirit, body or spirit, I'm sorry, join in singing the first hymn, number 112, Do You Hear? By our fearless leader on the worship committee, Paul Fackler, today is one of our members. As a welcoming congregation, we hope that all visitors, whoever they are, wherever they are on life's journey, and whatever their backgrounds, will find a lasting home here. Please join us for refreshments and conversation in the social hall after the service, and while you're there, stop by the welcome table to find out more about LCUUC. Today's order of service includes announcements of upcoming church activities, and we look forward to all of our visitors, friends, and members joining in. Please take a moment at this point in the service to deactivate noise-making devices, and welcome to everyone. We're pleased that you've chosen to celebrate and worship with us this morning, and we hope that as many people as can will also come back this afternoon.
One of the ways we care for the wider community is by contributing to the local food pantries, both financially and through collections of non-perishable food items, which we donate each month. If you have food items to share, please bring them forward at this time, or hand them to a child, as I invite the children to come forward for our story for all ages. Story today is by Patricia Polacco, and it is called The Art of Miss Chu. This is a biographical story, about how Patricia Pilato came to be a writer and illustrator. So this is one of the many books she's written. I discovered how much I loved art the summer I spent with my grandmother and father in Michigan. Grandma was an artist. She drew and painted so beautifully. Grandma even told me that I was a natural artist, so I couldn't wait to take art at school next fall when I got home to California. I only had one problem left: tests. I just couldn't seem to pass them. I was back in California and I loved school. Hard to believe, because once I had a lot of trouble reading, but not anymore. I really liked my new teacher, Mr. Donovan. He was from Ireland. He loved telling stories about his family back home, especially about his father. Seemed like he always had a smile on his face. But he didn't have a smile the day he handed back my first social studies test. I could feel my face get really hot when I unfolded it. An F again. The trouble was, everyone read faster than me. Even though I knew the subject real well, I'd run out of time before I was finished. Mr. Donovan finally sat me down. "You know the subject, Tricia. What you need is extra time." He started giving me extra time, and sure enough, I began passing the tests. But that didn't help my other problem. There was no real art class in my new school, just art on a cart for 30 minutes once a week. Next page. One day, Mr. Donovan saw one of my drawings. "Patricia, you have remarkable talent." I felt so proud. Next page. It wasn't a day later when Mr. Donovan told me about Miss Chu, head of the high school art department. "When I showed her your drawing, she said she wanted you in her special class. Now, what should be thinking of that, Miss Trish?" I loved drawing. Sometimes when I was drawing, I'd forget to breathe. I danced on the air all the way home that day. Next page. That first Tuesday, I'd never walked so fast in my life as I did to get to Miss Chu's class on time. I had never seen a room like hers. Then Miss Chu breezed into the room. Her smock was so covered in paint, it was a painting in itself. Next page. "In this class," said Miss Chu, "we are going to learn to speak another language." She touched her heart. "The language of art." Art? A language? But Miss Chu went on. "It isn't spoken. It is the language of emotions and images. But first," she told us, "you need to learn to see." She plopped down two salt shakers in the middle of the table. "Now draw the shakers, but first see them." Next page. "See how the light dances through the glass? See how you can make your pencil lines darker and lighter? Do your drawings again. Move the shakers off center. Let them run off the page." She made us draw those shakers six times in six different ways. And at the end of the day, she said, "Take your sketchbooks everywhere you go. First see, then draw." Next page. I couldn't wait. I took my sketchbook with me everywhere. I asked Mr. Donovan if I could make a drawing of his dog, his father, from the photo on his desk. I tried to remember everything Miss Chu told me. Next page. The next art class, Miss Chu called me up to her desk. Everyone else had handed in one or two sketches. I had done over 20. "Your drawings are very good. I particularly like your use of negative space." Negative space? "See this drawing?" "What do you see?" She held up a picture. Two people looking at each other. Anyone can see that. Do you see that in the drawing? You see the two faces looking at each other? Now, instead of looking at the two faces, look at what is between them. Well, there's nothing there. No, wait. There's a tall stemmed cup. What an idea. I started looking at all of my pictures for negative space. Next page. I was so happy. But a few weeks later, Mr. Donovan's father died. He left for Ireland the next day. That is when we got Mrs. Spaulding, a substitute. She never smiled. Worst of all, she wouldn't let me have extra time on the tests. Miss Spaulding said, "Your time would be better spent studying for your tests instead of leaving the school to take art classes. And I'm going to see if I can make that happen." Next page. I tried to be brave and not tell Miss Chu, but in class I began to cry and blurted out the threat that Miss Spaulding had made. Miss Chu began to shake her head slowly. She said, "You say you can't read fast enough to finish your tests. When you see a word, I think you don't see the letters at all at first. I think you see the space around them, the pattern they make." Next page. "No wonder your reading takes so much time," Miss Chu said. "I know someone I think can help, a reading specialist. No one is taking you from this class." I sprang to my feet and hugged her. Next page. The following day, Mrs. Spaulding announced we would have to take a citywide test that would determine what classes we would take next year. I only finished half the test. I knew my art class was over. But when I told Miss Chu, she said, "We'll see about that." With my mom's permission, she would take me herself to see her friend, the reading specialist. Next page. Dr. McClare played what seemed like 100 reading games with me, but I wasn't afraid. I knew he was trying to help. When he finally called Miss Chu in, he said, "You are spot on. She reads patterns, not words, and this takes time." Miss Chu wanted a meeting of all the players. Everyone came: the principal, Mrs. Spaulding, Miss Chu, Dr. McClare, and my mother. When she and Dr. McClare said that I see things differently than most students, Mrs. Spaulding scoffed. It was as if she didn't think art teachers were real teachers, that maybe art wasn't even a real class. Next page. Mr. Donovan came back 2 days later. I couldn't help myself. I ran to him and hugged him. "I'm so glad you're back," I said. When someone else told him what Mrs. Spaulding was trying to do, he got real red in the face. I don't know exactly what happened after that day, but it seemed Mrs. Spaulding was no longer needed as a substitute. So I went on to Miss Chu's class every Tuesday and Thursday. Next page. I decided to use the sketch of Mr. Donovan's father for my first painting. When I finished the painting, Miss Chu said, "This painting is going to be part of the art show. You will be the only exhibiting artist who isn't a high school student." Next page. Later that day, Miss Chu asked me to stay after class. She handed me a package. She said softly, "Remember this ancient Chinese proverb, yesterday is history, tomorrow a mystery, today a gift. That is why they call it the present." And she smiled. When I opened the gift, I caught my breath. It was one of Miss Chu's painting smocks. For me. Only a week later, I wore my new smock to the art show. Next page. So there's the art show, big happening event. And last page. Light was dancing off the mirror chandeliers. Our paintings were everywhere. I was so proud. Then I saw Mr. Donovan standing in front of my painting of his father. He couldn't speak. He took my hand and squeezed it. Miss Chu came up to us. She looked so radiant. I looked at the two of them. Miss Chu was right. This moment was the present. It turned out to be the defining moment in my young life. I was set on a course to be an artist. It could be no other way, thanks to the art of the amazing Miss Chu. So thank you for all coming down to listen to our story. And Caleb? Thank you. And please help sing the children out. We'll sing "Go Now in Peace" in the order of service.
Place because we love what exists here. This church is a living entity, and like all living things, it must have nurture and sustenance. Its breath and its heartbeat, its life itself, can only be derived from its living components, us. The offering will now be received. Thank you. service when we invite everyone to share their joys or concerns with the congregation. If you choose to share today, please raise your hand and state your name. When the usher brings the microphone, briefly state the joy or concern you wish to share, and I will light a candle to represent that. In this sharing, may our sorrows be lightened and our joys be multiplied.
This is Chris. I just want to say that the Little Church of Horrors was such a success this weekend. And if you worked here through the weekend, you can't believe what a transformation it was from what it looked like last night to today. So the people who worked on that did such a good job. So thank you so very much.
Hi, my name is Claire. I just wanted to give an update on my sister-in-law from last week. A week ago, she was in a tragic hiking accident and fell on her head. And she is still in critical care. However, she is doing very well. Doctors say she has been stable. And they have her in an induced coma right now, but they are slowly weaning her off of that in hopes that she will wake up soon.
Sounding can be an action, like a ringing of a bell or bringing words and music to life, but it is also a measure of depth, as used by ships. You remember Mark Twain was the second mark on a sounding rope. And it is a way of probing or testing opinions and intentions. We sound them out. So as we listen to these various words today, I was very verbose, so there's multiple soundings, as you can see in your order portion. And I selected these soundings because each is tied to talking about vocation. What is it that calls to us? Our first sounding is from the Bible, Exodus 3, 1 to 10, from the Contemporary English Version. One day Moses was taking care of the sheep and goats of his father-in-law Jethro, the priest of Midian, and Moses decided to lead them across the desert to Sinai, the holy mountain. There, an angel of the Lord appeared to him from a burning bush. Moses saw that the bush was on fire, but it was not burning up. "This is strange," he said to himself. "I'll go over and see why the bush isn't burning up." When the Lord saw Moses coming near the bush, he called him by name, and Moses answered him, "Here I am." God replied, "Don't come any closer. Take off your sandals. The ground where you are standing is holy. I am the God who was worshipped by your ancestors, Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob." Moses was afraid to look at God, and so he hid his face. The Lord said, "I have seen how my people are suffering as slaves in Egypt, and I have heard them beg for my help because of the way they are being mistreated. I feel sorry for them, and I have come down to rescue them from the Egyptians. I will bring my people out of Egypt and into a country where there is good land, rich with milk and honey. My people have begged for my help, and I have seen how cruel the Egyptians are to them. Now go to the king. I am sending you to lead the people out of his country." That's the end of the reading.
Our second sounding is from Peter Buffett's book, Life is What You Make It. Peter Buffett is the son of the billionaire investor Warren Buffett. He is a composer and producer, and more recently the co-chair of the Novo Foundation, an organization dedicated to catalyzing a transformation in global society, moving from a culture of domination and exploitation to one of equality and partnership. Buffett writes, "Discovering a true vocation is a huge milestone on the way to making our lives what we want them to be, but it's only a first step. Buying time to explore the implications and challenges of that vocation is also an important process, but it's only a second step. The big question that remains is this: once we found our vocation, what do we do with it? I am enough of a Midwesterner and enough of my father's son to take a very pragmatic view of this question. If we want our vocations to become our livelihoods rather than hobbies or vague dreams of things we'll get around to someday, then the hard and simple truth is that we have to find a way to make them pay. This brings us to another of those delicate junctures where the pendulum of social fashion has swung and swung again. I'm talking about how we regard the interplay between what we'd like to do and what we need to do. More precisely, I'm talking about the complex relationship between what we ourselves value and what the outside world will pay us for. Back in the 1960s and 70s, many young people tended to be obsessed and horrified by the notion of selling out. Any engagement with the marketplace was suspect. Working for a big company or corporation was highly suspect. The idea seemed to be that by taking a straight job or fulfilling a demand from a boss or pleasing a client, we were necessarily being untrue to ourselves. And more than that, we were betraying the ideals and uniqueness of our entire generation. In more recent years, under the stress of much dicier economic prospects, the pendulum has swung once more. These days, many people, seasoned professionals as well as those just entering the workforce, seem blithely unconcerned about selling out. Instead, they tend to seem a bit frantic with the pressure of buying in. Rather than being suspicious of the marketplace, they are only too eager to embrace it and to adopt its values without much questioning. But what about their own values, their own passions, their own convictions about what constitutes a well-lived life? When times are tough and the future looks murky, there is, I believe, a tendency to see one's own dreams and preferences as luxuries one can't afford. The immediate concern is to get a job and keep it. While this attitude is entirely understandable, I don't think it holds up as a long-term formula for happiness and self-respect. Let me be clear that I'm not advocating a return to dropping out and hippiedom. I accept and even celebrate the necessity of earning a living. Earning a living is one of life's character-defining challenges. What I am trying to get across, however, is the idea of balance. If we hope to be true to ourselves, to fulfill our vocations while also paying the rent and putting bread on the table, we need to find the sweet spot where our individual abilities and inclinations intersect with the world of commerce. We need to figure out what it is we genuinely like to do and that the world will value enough to buy. In an introduction to one of his short story collections, Bernard Malamud remarked that no good writer writes exactly as he pleases. What Malamud was saying, I believe, is that it's a myth to imagine that a professional writer, however gifted or experienced, simply sits down at the keyboard and lets the words flow. No, there's another step involved, a mediation. There's the author's impulse, which is passionate. Then there's a consideration of the potential audience, which is practical. And the finished piece of work is the offspring of those two factors. Note that I don't call it a compromise. It is not a compromise. Rather, it represents the application of several different skills, each of which is an integral part of talent. Lesson, put simply, is this: when we do something for pay, whether it's writing a story or digging a ditch, we need to please the person paying us, but that doesn't make the work any less our own. The paradox is that the finished product, whatever it happens to be, belongs to us as much as to the buyer. We've put our own stamp on it. We've brought our uniqueness to it. Because it is part of what we've done, it has become a part as well of who we are. Accepting this paradox of selling something yet still possessing it is part of how we become professional.
Our next sounding is a song from the American hip-hop duo called Blackalicious. The group is made up of the rapper Gift of Gab, born Timothy Parker, and the DJ-producer Chief Excel, born Xavier Mosley. So this song is from their 2005 album called The Craft, and the song itself is called The Craft. I'd like you to listen closely to the production of the singer. And listen closely about the lyrics are about being called to perform.
This craft, this beat, this rhyme, this vibe, this style. They say music gives the life from a source inside that is forever flowing. This stage, this mic, this crowd, this show, this life. I've been given a gift tonight. And for that, I'm about to be a vessel. I didn't have to be given the gift to rip. I'll never master me. I know that it's from him or her or it. Dimensions exist waiting to slip through me. I fall short, still it hits me swift. I didn't have to see. I could have hit the lick. I could have drifted quick. I could have quit so quick. It's really a trip. I guess I was picked. I don't know what I did to deserve a ride like this. I didn't have to eat. I could have been so thin. I didn't have to be for any sentences. I didn't have to reap the work put in, but then even the work in itself was such a blessing. I didn't have to see the planet tip to tip. I didn't have to make a living rich to rich. I didn't have to dream and then begin to live it. And for that, I vow to be a vessel. This craft, this beat, this rhyme, this vibe, this style. They say music gives me life from a source inside that is forever flowing. This stage, this mic, this crowd, this show, this life. I've been given a gift tonight. And for that, I vow to be a vessel. I give thanks for my rhyming ability. I don't front like it's not a responsibility. I can open a mind if the youth will listen to me. I'm not gonna front like I'm on some killing spree. And as hard as the time for a God that's living through beats that come not from mine, but they travel through spiritual regions. Some of the time I feel like it's not even me. No money can buy gateways to infinity. Still I'm hungry to shine when I know it's just let it be. And I want, but I have every single thing that I need. So help me align self with soul, and then I'll be free to scope and design verbal styles and experience free. This craft, this beat, this rhyme, this vibe, this style. They say music gives the life from a source inside that is forever flowing. This stage, this mic, this crowd, this show, this life. I've been given a gift tonight. And for that, I vow to be a vessel.
Let go. Do what's in front of you. Then let go. Then do what's in front of you.
This ain't leisure, although it feels. It is a duty, a way to live, another way to give, another way to just have communion with the source of the sun and moon, and a way to pay the bills, displaying skills. I'm taking real serious, survive so mysterious, not just one more day to kill. And I can lose my connection if I do not respect it enough, fade away it will. Day to day it gives energies that replenish me if I believe, and I say it will, and act on it, cause action is the key to freedom, only way to be a leader, lead by the way you live. This craft, this beat, this rhyme, this vibe, this style, they say music gives me life.
Our fourth sounding is an excerpt from Wendell Berry's The Idea of a Local Economy, which was originally published in Orion magazine in winter 2001. Berry is an American novelist, poet, environmental activist, cultural critic, and farmer. Berry writes, "The folly at the root of this foolish global economy began with the idea that a corporation should be regarded legally as a person. But the limitless destructiveness of this economy comes about precisely because a corporation is not a person. A corporation essentially is a pile of money to which a number of persons have sold their moral allegiance. It goes about its business with the single purpose of becoming a bigger pile of money. Unsurprisingly, among people who wish to preserve things other than money, there is a growing perception that the global free market economy is inherently an enemy to the natural world, to human health and freedom, to industrial workers and to farmers and others in the land use economies. And furthermore, that it is inherently an enemy to good work and good economic practice. I believe that this perception is correct, and that it can be shown to be correct merely by listing the assumptions implicit in the idea that corporations should be free to buy low and sell high in the world at large. These assumptions, so far as I can make them out, are as follows. One, that a stable and preserving relationship that stable and preserving relationships among people, places, and things do not matter and are no worth. Two, that cultures and religion have no legitimate practical or economic concerns. Number four, that there can be no conflict between economic advantage and economic justice. Six, that there is no conflict between self-interest and public service. Number 13, that an economy is a machine of which people are merely the interchangeable parts. One has no choice but to do the work, if any, that the economy prescribes, and to accept the prescribed wages. Some of you may remember when HR turned people into human resources, like coal. 14, that therefore vocation is a dead issue. One does not do the work that one chooses to do because one is called by heaven or by one's natural or God-given abilities, but does instead the work that is determined and imposed by the economy. Any work is all right as long as one gets paid for it. These assumptions clearly prefigure a condition of total economy. A total economy is one in which everything, life forms, for instance, or the right to pollute, is private property and has a price and is for sale. In a total economy, significant and sometimes critical choices that once belonged to individuals or communities become the property of corporations. A total economy is an unrestrained taking of profits from the disintegration of nations, communities, households, landscapes, and ecosystems. It licenses symbolic or artificial wealth to grow by means of the destruction of the real wealth of all the world. Among the many costs of the total economy, the loss of the principle of vocation is probably the most symptomatic and, from a cultural standpoint, the most critical. It is by the replacement of vocation with economic determinism that the exterior workings of a total economy destroy the character and culture also from the inside. In an essay on the origin of civilization in traditional cultures, Ananda K. Kumar Swami wrote that the principle of justice is the same throughout. It is that each member of the community should perform the task for which he is fitted by nature. The two ideas, justice and vocation, are inseparable. That is why Kumar Swami spoke of industrialism as the mammon of injustice, incompatible with civilization. It is by way of the principle and practice of vocation that sanctity and reverence enter into the human economy. It was thus possible for traditional cultures to conceive that to work is to pray. I'm a man of many words today, so raise your hand if your brain is full at some point. You can sleep then. For some, like Moses, a bush catches fire nearby and you have to go investigate. For others, like Saul, on the road to Damascus, a light, like an oncoming locomotive, falls onto you when there's a voice. And after a week of blindness, you're changed, even down to your name. Some, like Harry Potter, get a letter that arrives when you turn 11. A letter that keeps delivering itself to overcome anyone who would try and stop it. A letter that opens a magical world behind the world. Others, like Luke Skywalker, get misdirected intergalactic mail. A message intended for someone else. A cry for help from a princess in distress. And that starts the chain of events that changes an empire. Some, like Helen Keller, suddenly wake up to water running over your hand, and a teacher like Anne Sullivan spelling the word water, and it connects the thing and the word, words as ideas. We all want to be found. We want to hear a call, something that grabs us and shakes us, turns us upside down and empties our pockets, something that rips us out of the mundane and sets us on a road to change the world. We want it to look like a burning bush and a letter from Hogwarts and sound like Niagara Falls and a freight train and your mobile phone ringing. And when you pick it up, the voice on the line says, "I choose you." We want a calling to be intentional and obvious. We want it to be movie material. Or do we? Is tending the sheep for 40 years an okay thing to do? Quietly selling used cars or insurance? Planting pumpkins on the farm? Raising a family in a suburb? Can these choices be callings as well? Have you been called? Is your work your vocation, your calling? Or maybe something less than that? What does it even mean to be called? We are perhaps most familiar with the idea of a divine call. The Bible is filled with various people getting called by God to do something. Moses is called from sheep and goat herding to free Israel from Egypt. Jesus calls the disciples from being fishermen. Priests and pastors are called to their jobs. A call is that divine summons to religious work. In a somewhat less religious sense, we often think of the helping and healing professions as vocations. Nurses, doctors, veterinarians, social workers, scientists dedicated to finding a cure for cancer, teachers, police and rescue workers, any kind of humanitarian work, often underpaid. These are callings and vocations. And then there are the arts. Writers, musicians, actors, painters, those with an inner voice that drive them to create the things that we call art. We still think of these arts as inspired, that something divine is breathed into them. In the song The Craft that we listen to, The Gift of Gab repeats the phrase, "I've been given a gift tonight, and for that, I vow to be a vessel." The artist is the vessel that the divine passes through into the world. Peter Buffett, in the excerpt you heard, uses the writer Bernard Malamud as an example of someone with a vocation, someone who balances the vocation of writing with making a living. We can easily extend the idea of vocation to craftsmanship, those with the skills to build and finish things, furniture making, cooking and baking, haberdashery, cabinetry, stonework, engineering and design. There's an art to making the day-to-day functional things, comfortable shoes, awesome toothbrush technology, the chairs we sit in, a blender that blends when we plug it in, the solidity of a wooden floor or of a roof that doesn't leak. The idea of vocation is not dead, not yet, but aren't we describing a kind of hierarchy here? As the thing that calls us moves from the divine to the humanitarian, to an inner voice, to a personal work ethic, to simply a paycheck, what is being lost? As we replace a work ethic with a wealth ethic and build what Wendell Berry calls the total economy, are we building a world of economic determinism in which every sense of vocation will eventually be dead? Now, I like Peter Buffett. He's a pragmatist, and as he states, if we want our vocations to be our livelihoods rather than hobbies or vague dreams of things we'll get around to someday, then the hard and simple truth is that we have to find a way to make them pay. Working for pay is not a sellout. It is not a compromise. Rather, for Buffett, it is a paradox of selling something and yet still possessing it. So this seems on the face of it to be pretty sound advice. It makes me feel comfortable. Buffett is saying that we should treasure our values, our passions and convictions. We should not give them up just to earn money. He's arguing that a worker needs to take a kind of pride and ownership in the work being done. He is saying that the work itself is part of who the worker is, part of what defines the worker, that it is heartfelt. So as Buffett says, whether it's writing a story or digging a ditch, we need to please the person paying us, but that doesn't make the work any less our own. But what if I'm a writer who is digging ditches in order to earn money so that I can eat and have time to write? Certainly a work ethic tells me to take pride in my ditch digging, even though it is not my vocation. I can bring my tenacity, my pride, my desire for excellence to the work of ditch digging, just as I would bring it to my writing. But at bottom, the disjuncture between ditch digging and writing is huge. And I'm just using the ditch digging to buy time, literally to buy it, with money that I earn. I place a higher value on the writing. This is a personal value, not a monetary value. But that value can only be asserted after my basic needs have been taken care of. If things work out right somehow, I'll move from ditch digging to writing. But if they don't work out, won't the ditch digging subsume my writing? Which scenario is more likely? As much as I agree with Buffett on having a pride and ownership in the work being done, in the end, I think he is dead wrong about needing to please the person paying us. In essence, Buffett is selling out. He is selling out because his own pragmatic requirement is that selling has to be an option. There is a person who is paying us. Work has to have an economic component, a being sold, a way of commanding price, And this requirement that work have a selling value, even if it is work that we feel is a core part of us, which it is not by any means always true, means that his concept of work, and thus of vocation, is tied to the machine of the economy. Now, Wendell Berry sounds like an Old Testament prophet. I haven't seen his picture. He may look like one as well. But he lays out to me what sounds like an Old Testament prophet to me, as he lays out what he believes are the implicit assumptions in the idea of a global free market economy. The assumptions that make this global free market economy an enemy to work and good economic practice. Assumptions that undermine and take apart Buffett's attempt to create a balance. To repeat two of the evils of this system that we heard previously, that an economy is a machine of which people are merely the interchangeable parts. One has no choice but to do the work, if any, that the economy provides, and to accept the prescribed wage. And that, therefore, vocation is dead, is a dead issue. One does not do the work that one chooses to do because one is called to it by heaven or by one's natural or God-given abilities, but does instead the work that is determined and imposed by the economy. Any work is all right as long as one gets paid for it. Now, Buffett is certainly not saying that any work is all right as long as one gets paid for it. He quite clearly indicates that his premise is that workers are balancing their vocation with their livelihood. Berry would argue that Buffett has lost the idea of what vocation actually is as soon as he lets the economic machine in any way play a role. The economic machine specifies the role. It takes choice from the person doing the work. It replaces your values with the values of the marketplace. I would additionally say that Buffett appears to be arguing from a privileged position of having had the economic ability to embark on his vocation as a musician because he was not forced by circumstances to work in a McDonald's or a meatpacking plant or as a ditch digger to survive at all. The existence of a music industry that he can step into simplifies his whole life pursuit. The ability to earn a living is not something everyone has, even outside of one's vocation, to say nothing of being able to do so within a vocation. So let me back up a moment. Why are we talking about vocation at all? At bottom, it is because I want to justify what I do in the world. I want there to be meaning to what I do. And I think this is true of all of us. I would like to talk about my vocation with some of the same self-satisfaction that Peter Buffett does. I want to be able to explain to myself why, if I was asked what my vocation is and what I do for a living, that there would be two different answers. What do I do for a living? I work as a systems administrator for the corporate offices of a company called Telephone Data Systems. That is, I take care of computer systems that, among other things, make sure you get your phone bills. Is this a job I am called to? That anyone on earth is called to? I can assure you I don't feel called to it. This is a job that the machine of the economy provides. It's a good job, it's a good company, and it pays the bills. And what is my vocation? Well, that's a harder question for me. At one time I might have said I'm a poet or a writer, not because it's a job, but because it is something I do without being paid, something I want to do. I would have made the distinction between my job and my vocation by saying, writing is something I live to do, not that I do to live. I don't sell it. If there were no other demands on my life, I would still do it. Berry, for me, is accusatory of the life I'm living. After all, when I read an essay like The Idea of a Local Economy, I feel like I ought to dump my job, go out, buy some land, and farm. But I don't do this. Berry makes me uncomfortable, dissatisfied. I want to argue with him because I don't want him to be right, because I don't think that the global economy in itself is in itself the death of vocation or the enemy of the natural world to human health and freedom, to industrial workers and to farmers, or that it is inherently an enemy to good work and good economic practice. Could it be? Yes. Does it behave as Berry describes it? Yes. There is a logic of destruction to it that needs to be contained, that we need to understand and to deal with. While Buffett gives me some comfort with his pragmatism, and for me, a bit too much platitude with life is what you make it, he undermines what he offers by proposing the ability to sell your vocation. I think he has the weaker view of what a vocation is. Barry, even after making me feel on one level that I have sold out or made myself a puppet to the global free market economy that will destroy even the possibility of vocation, presents two ideas that I keep coming back to. One, that justice and vocation are inseparable. And two, that to work is to pray. Barry does not take time in his essay to explicate what either of these two statements might fully mean. So this is my attempt to unravel them. How are justice and vocation linked to each other? Think of the calling of Moses. Moses is mired in a kind of complacency, tending the sheep and goats. It's a good job. It pays the bills. But along comes God in a burning bush, and God says, there are people suffering, and I've decided to do something about it. I'm sending you, Moses, to Egypt to free them. The call that comes to Moses is from outside him. It rises from the suffering of the people of Israel, from their calling out and praying to God, and it passes to Moses as a demand to bring about justice. The call is not about Moses. It is about the need for justice in the community that he has fled, but is still tied to. Vocation, Barry is saying, is not about a job, no matter how heartfelt. Vocation is not about me, as if I were the only thing in the world. It is not about me in isolation or with a singularity of focus to writing or ditch digging. It is about relationship. Relationship to other people, to places, to all the things around me. It is about relationship to where I am right now, to my immediate community and locality. It is not about accumulation of wealth or even finding personal happiness and satisfaction. It is outwardly focused. It is a call from something outside myself, through me, to something outside of myself, something for which I am a vessel. It is about me speaking for the things around me. What are the words that Barry uses? Justice, service, sanctity, reverence. These are the ways that I ought to behave in the world. And if I can behave this way, even when I am working for the man or the global free market economy, I have a vocation. Vocation is not a compartment to your life tied to your job. It is your whole life. What I do to live and what I live to do both have to be taken into account and refocused through a community that proposes an economy based on values, justice, service, sanctity, reverence, the inherent worth and dignity of everyone. This is how I find meaning in my life, in what I do. We are practicing our vocation right now. Are you called to this community? To LCUUC? Maybe you don't feel you were called this morning because there was no burning bush or lost droid or letter from Hogwarts, but you're here by choice and intention. Does this community call out through you? Does it pass through you to wherever you go and to whatever you do? Whether or not the words say it properly or completely, I think the gift of gab makes me feel what it's like to have a vocation. So how does he say it? Like this. This craft, this beat, this rhyme, this vibe, this style. They say music gives new life from a source inside that is forever flowing. This stage, this mic, this crowd, this show, this life, I've been given a gift tonight, and for that, I vow to be a vessel. Barry says that to work is to pray. Take that idea with you. Explore it. And think about this. We will be installing our minister here today at LCUUC, a minister we called. We are so wrapped up sometimes in the idea of a calling coming to us that we forget that we too are calling. We are so busy listening that we forget that we can speak. To work is to pray. To pray is to speak out our own desires into existence, to call out. To pray is to create a ministry and to give thanks for it. We have some time for polylog. So the ushers will bring around the microphones if anybody has a comment or if they need to clear their brain and just kind of...
Hi, I'm Mary. Paul, thank you for talking about a subject that's really near and dear to my heart. 10 years ago, I went back to school to study vocational psychology. And the thing that I spend most of my time studying is the intersection of gender, race and ethnicity, and socioeconomic status with the jobs that we take. So I'm never really interested anymore in talking about vocational psychology because jobs are so determined by our identities. And the structure of opportunity that's really available for most people is so different and so dependent on their identity. So now I think more about the psychology of work, and I think less that vocation is really a concept, not that we can't find meaning in our work, but for the vast majority of people, it's really not a concept that has a lot of meaning. So I really feel a lot of tension. In the end of your talk, you started talking about privilege, and that's really the concept of vocation really is so tightly linked to privilege.
Thank you.
Hi, this is Kaz. This is so fitting to what I'm going through right now. I started out teaching Japanese at Arrowhead High School. It was coincidence of unreal coincidence. I just said one day, oh, maybe I should teach, do some substitute teaching. And right in dance, a friend of mine said, oh, you know, they're going to cancel the Japanese program at Arrowhead High School because they couldn't find a part-time teacher for that subject. And I said, oh. She said, why don't you apply for it? And I said, oh, okay. For that kind of attitude, I went into teaching. I was hired practically on the spot. And now it's 12 years later. This is my last year of teaching. And the reason why this has become to be a last year of teaching is the budget crunch. There is not a budget for it, and Japanese is a very unique language, and there just isn't that many kids taking them. So it's coming to an end, and I really wanted to end my last teaching with my last class going through, which is this class that I have now. And that wasn't to be last year. They were going to pay for it. And one of the parents stepped in and said to the administration that they were going to pay for it. So the parents is paying for my last class, ending in a fantastic note. I have a student that just loves to learn this language. And I said, wow, this my vocation is coming to end. And I don't know what, you know, I'm going to be retiring. And lo and behold, there is all kinds of talk about teaching Japanese online so that there's a lot of kids who wants to learn that they don't have access to, could access to. And so I have these kids. I don't know how they find me, but contacting me on the Facebook. Wanted to be my friend because, and so, you know, it's just amazing how, I don't know, vocation is calling, or vocation is a chance, or vocation is, you know, you got something that people need, you know. I just wanted to share my story.
Thank you.
Thank you.
This is Gus over here. One of the mottos, the religious orders, Benedictines, Jesuits, they've all got their mottos in Latin, of course. And one of the mottos for the Benedictine order is ora et labora, which is prayer and work. And that notion goes, you know, way back. In the religious orders, where there was work that was always required of the members, of the monks. And, of course, everything was tied to prayer and my personal relationship with God. which ties into the second comment I want to make is, and you touched on this, Paul, that Moses received a call. There had to be the person that was calling, of course, who was God. And God, by calling Moses, gave Moses an identity and a task, and the two were very closely tied together. Moses had to figure out not only how he was going to respond to God, but what he was going to say then to the Israelites to get them to understand that this is something he has to do. So I guess the point I'm trying to make is that vocation is the first thing I have to figure out who I am. And I have to figure out what my relationship is to this big world out here, whether you want to call it God or the universe or whatever. And then how I'm going to translate that into what I'm going to say and do deal with other people. Even though I ended up leaving the monastery only after 6 years, I feel like the work I've been doing on a personal level, trying to wake people up spiritually, philosophically, what have you, but you can call it whatever you want, is integral to my waking myself up and to keeping myself spiritually alive. And from that standpoint, I don't feel like I ever broke my vows in the religious order. I still am a Benedictine in my heart because I've been true to that mission that it is my job to keep myself and other people spiritually alive, if that makes any sense.
That makes sense. I think that's the angle I take on it. I don't feel I've sold out as long as I'm true to the values I have inside me, whatever it is I'm doing.
I look at the young people that are coming up and I hear them speaking like my grandchildren, and it seems like for very, very many of them, the main concern is, where am I going to make enough money? Where are the jobs? And that's our society. That is that corporate world that the companies have become supposedly a person and they dictate. I mean, it's like they're the real main rulers of the world, not even the presidents or the prime ministers. And I don't know how we can go back to having enough of the liberal arts in the schools to make the students think, because they're not really, in many instances, taught to think. They're just taught to take the test so they get a high score, so they can get into a good school. And even that is privilege if you can afford it. The rest of the, I mean, what percentage anymore will be able to get out of school without owing between $40,000 and $100,000? And then they're really caught. I look at those kids as serfs eventually. Because I don't see what the society is going to do, and it does sound desperate, doesn't it? I'm sorry, I sound so desperate, but
Wendell Berry sounds like that as well. I mean, Wendell Berry, but it has propositions on exactly what you should do, which has a lot to do with a local economy, where you don't transfer your values. I mean, Target, you could go to work for Target to earn money to pay back your bills. Are you called to work to Target? Is that really part of your community? Or are you called to something that is tightly tied, a group like this, which is value-based, which you come to because it ties to the values you already have, as opposed to simply going, okay, I can ignore my values for some amount of time just to earn the money. So Barry's got a lot of the same difficulty. He's got the end of the world is coming kind of viewpoint is the tendency I get from some of his essays. But he believes, as a push for the local, bringing back the local economy. If you do things locally, you're with the people you're working with. You are focused on people. You're not focused on an imaginary corporation.
As far as the students, there's a book out. I just remember because I read it, called Walden on Wheels. It's a young man who comes out of college and owes $40,000 and it scares the living data. I mean, it really bothers him, and he ends up going up. So that's a big, big story. But in the end, he works
away from home, work from away from everything. His main goal is to make money and pay off the bills so he finds a job where his needs are taken care of as far as food and shelter and all of that. And he doesn't earn all that much, but he every penny he earns, he pays back into it. And not everybody can do that. And he still owes money when he's done a number of years later, you know. So I don't know. I mean, it's if you have a job that doesn't pay much.
I would say not everybody feels comfortable doing that, but everybody can do that. I mean, there's nothing to keep you from dropping out of the society that forces you have to work for your living. There was a time at one point where people actually said, we're moving towards a future in which people will not have to work. And so they weren't asking the question, what do you do when you retire? They said, what will we do when we don't have to work because all our needs will be covered? And that question is dropped out. That is not a question a business ever asks. A business says there will always be work and somebody will have to do it. One more.
Paul, am I on?
I think not.
There. Paul, thanks very much for this really inspiring conversation. One more perspective is from that place in life that has been labeled, quote-unquote, retirement. And what my perspective is from there is that the challenge of vocation simply isn't something that you figured out at 20 or 50 or 60, but actually is a continually ongoing challenge, and that the sense of having some integrity simply changes. It's a moving target, I guess that's what I'm trying to say. So thanks very much, Paul.
Thank you. And we can talk further in the social hall afterwards.
We extinguish the chalice here that it might glow gently in our hearts. May it light your path as you leave this place. May it guide your way until we are together again. Please stand in body or spirit and join in singing the closing hymn, number 86, Blessed Spirit of My Life. And then if you'll please remain standing for the benediction.
Philosopher, architect, and inventor known to many of his friends and fans as Bucky, wrote in his posthumously published work, Cosmography, every child has an enormous drive to demonstrate competence. If humans are not required to earn a living to be provided survival needs, many are not going to want very much to many are going to want to very much be productive, but not at those tasks they did not choose to do, but were forced to accept in order to earn money. Instead, humans will spontaneously take upon themselves those tasks that world society really needs to have done. Be that child in the world. Do the work that calls to you.
Given the gift to rip, I'll never master me. I know that it's from him, or her, or it. That makes a decision waiting to slip through me. I fall short, still it hits me swift. I didn't have to see, I could've hit the lick. I could've drifted quick, I could've quit so quick. It's really a trip, I guess I was picked. I don't know what I did to deserve a ride like this. I didn't have to eat, I could've been so thin. I didn't have to be, for any sentences. I didn't have to reap, the work put in but then. Even the work in itself is such a blessing. I didn't have to see, the planet chip to chip. I didn't have to make a living rich to rich. I didn't have to dream and then begin to live it. After that, I vow to be a best. This craft, this beat, this rhyme, this vibe, this style. This ain't music, gives the life from a source beside that is forever playing. This stage, this life, this crowd, this show, this life. I've been given a gift tonight. I give thanks for my rhyming ability. I don't front like it's not a responsibility. I can open a mind if the youth will listen to me. I'm not gonna front like I'm on some chemistry. And as hard as the times are, God is living through beasts that come not from minds, but they travel through spiritual reasons. Some of the time I feel like it's not even me. No money can buy gateways to infinity. Still I'm hungry to shine when I know I should let it be. And I want, but I have every single thing that I need. So help me align self with soul, and then I'll be free to scope and design verbal styles and experience free. This craft, this beat, this rhyme, this vibe, this style. They say music gives the light from a source inside that is forever playing. This stage, this life, this crowd, this show, this life. I've been given a gift tonight. And for that, I'll vow to be a vessel.
Let's go. Do what's in front of you. Then let go. Then do what's in front of you.
This ain't leisure, although it feels. It is a duty, a way to live, another way to give, another way to just have communion with the source of the sun and moon, and a way to pay the bills, display of skills. I take it real serious, the vibe so mysterious, not just one more day to kill. And I could lose my connection if I do not respect it enough, fade away it will. Day to day it gives energies that replenish me if I believe and I say it will, and act on it, cause action is the key to freedom, only way to be a leader, lead by the way you live.